Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Monday, the 6th of February. All things political coming up momentarily with a great guest who writes really good articles because she gives you information that go beneath the obvious. Jill Lawrence will be joining us, National Journal's Managing Editor for Politics. Hour two of our show today. I should have brought a chocolate cake, and I was going to, but I couldn't find the car keys, and they were in the purse, but I was looking around the house, and I had cake ready because we are celebrating a day early the 200th birthday of Charles Dickens, who said there is nothing better than a friend unless it is a friend with chocolate. So if you want to have your chocolate ready for hour two of our show, he's always been one of my favorite authors. We will talk about Charles Dickens, hour two of the program this Monday. All things political. Here's our phone number. We have the Nevada caucuses to talk about, the unemployment rate dropping slightly, and other issues. Our phone number for Jill Lawrence is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Jill Lawrence is our guest, National Journal's Managing Editor for Politics. Jill has also served as Senior Correspondent and Columnist for Politics Daily, National Political Correspondent for USA Today, National Political Writer for the Associated Press. She's written about politics and policy for the Daily Beast, the Atlantic, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and other publications. She has covered every presidential campaign since 1988 and many other historic events, including the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the 1994 Republican takeover of Congress, the Clinton impeachment, the Florida recount, and the 1993 and 2009 battles over health reform. She has taught journalism at American University and has appeared at other universities lecturing and as a panelist. Jill, thank you very much for being with us. Oops, we got the right button here. Hi, Jill. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Well, I guess the carrier pigeons must have arrived, huh? Because we got the news this morning what the final vote was in the Nevada caucus.
Well, we did. It was, I think, 2 a.m. Pacific time. Whoa. The tweet came across from the party at 5:06 a.m. Eastern. And the results were not surprising. There was surprise, though, in that it took so long to get them. I mean, that was just really amazing.
Yeah. What's wrong with this caucus system? Because in Iowa, you had a completely different result.
Well, that's true. And it's such an informal process. And, you know, I was not that impressed with the Democrats either in 2008 in Nevada. You just have people showing up and lining up. They can, in that instance, for you could register on your way in to vote. And you just had people in lines on both sides of the room and a very informal count. Plus, you know, you can't get an absentee ballot or vote early or anything like that. So you just have to show up. And it's not at all like a primary. And, we can see in the counts that these people are not that well trained. The parties run these caucuses. And in Iowa, a switch of about 40 votes turned out a different winner. Plus, they had 8 precincts missing. So we'll actually never know who won.
Right. They are kind of fun, though.
Well, they are. I mean, in a sense, they're democracy in action. The Las Vegas caucuses 4 years ago had a lot of casino workers, kitchen workers, bellhops, maids, you know, just all kinds of people in their uniforms. It was pretty interesting to watch. But it's not fair to people who can't get to these caucuses, and
yes,
it's really not fair when the votes aren't counted.
So why do states do these caucuses? Why don't they switch and do primaries?
I think primaries are much more expensive, and also you kind of lose control of them to the states, because the Secretary of State of a state would then run it. But you'd have to ask the parties. I think it's a party-building exercise, so they probably prefer it in some cases. We have 2 more tomorrow night.
In watching the returns from Nevada, so many of the commentators were saying the inevitable Mitt Romney, he's going to be the presidential nominee. Is there no doubt after Nevada, or do you have a doubt?
I only have maybe a shred of doubt. Part of the problem is his competition. I mean, well, it's not a problem for him. His competition has weak campaigns. There's no organization in the Gingrich campaign, and the Santorum campaign doesn't have much money and also doesn't have much organization. So they're going state to state one by one, hoping for the best, but you know, Romney has done this before, and he's well-financed and well-organized nationally, not just in one state or the next. So, and also, he just seems to be the most competent candidate in terms of the issue of the day, which is the economy, and the most even in his performance. Gingrich is very erratic, as I'm sure people have noticed. And Rick Santorum has gone from message to message, from the social conservative to now the true conservative. At one point, he was going to be the Rust Belt manufacturing candidate. It's all, you know, people are trying different things, and I think Romney is got just an unassailable advantage here.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about the demographic groups, that he pretty much swept them across the board on Saturday in Nevada.
It's true. I mean, obviously, it's a Republican electorate, so we don't know how he'll do in a general election. There were a few signs of places where a Democrat or his Republican rivals might make some inroads. Low-income people, young people. These were people who went for Paul. Independents, they tended to go for Paul also.
Mm-hmm. And what does it do to the, although it's early now, and we're looking at eensy-beensy, bitsy improvement in the economy, unemployment rate going down just slightly. You asked the question, what will happen to the Republican narrative about the miserable Obama economy if things continue to improve throughout 2012? I guess there are two questions. What will happen, and do you think that things will improve during 2012?
Well, the what will happen question, it's interesting because that piece was originally written in advance for National Journal magazine, and it was based on a Gallup poll that found that the employment index was at its highest in 3 years. So, and then the next day after, well, I guess the same day it came out, we had the unemployment rate dropping to 8.3%, which was a total shock to all the analysts and prognosticators. So I think it's possible that this could keep happening, and then I think that the Republican have a problem, particularly Mitt Romney has a problem, because this is the central thesis of his campaign, that Obama has failed on the economy. Well, if the economy's perking up, maybe he didn't fail. Maybe people are feeling better about things. And so then his argument becomes, well, I could have done better. Well, that's, you know, that's a hard argument to make. It's about as weak as Obama's argument that things could have been worse without me. So that's, you know, that's one thing. Now, will it continue to improve? There are so many external factors that could affect this that I think that Obama can just cross his fingers and hope that Europe doesn't implode. We're right on the edge now of a Greece implosion. So, you know, anything could happen on that front. And also oil prices, you know, will tensions with Iran rise? There's just all kinds of circumstances over which nobody has any control.
You do cite the Congressional Budget Office in the article saying the unemployment rate could return to 9% by November. What's the story beneath that? Why do they say that?
Well, I think the main thing that everyone is looking for is whether people who've dropped out of the labor force will suddenly become optimists and start looking for work again. So ironically, that'll make the statistics look worse because there'll be more people looking for work who can't find it. And, you know, that's one of the problems, if you want to call that a problem.
It seems to me as though Mitt Romney is going to have a problem in the upcoming months, and even more so if he is the nominee and the Democrats go at him on money and where he has put his money so that he doesn't, you know, it's all legal, but putting your money in places like the Cayman Islands seemed to me to be problematic for the general electorate, that he's just living in a different kind of world. Do we begrudge him that? Do we think that he can't identify with us because of this enormous amount of money? Should he have not put his money in the Cayman Islands? Is that problematic for him?
Well, I think the money is problematic for him, and it's kind of the root of a lot of problems. It shows that he doesn't have a lot of finesse as a candidate because he hasn't really handled the question very well. And it also kind of goes to the core narrative that the Democrats will use against him. So when you have Republicans staying in the race, for instance, Newt Gingrich, who has until this point made a big deal of his money, I think he's stopped talking about that a little bit, but now he's kind of morphed that into he doesn't care much about the poor, which is the same thing when you really get at it. He's out of touch. So, you know, having this primary go on for a long time, as Gingrich has vowed it will, that's not helpful either. So you have a lot of things working against him on the money front, but I think if it would quiet down and he would learn to handle the question in a disarming way or a humorous way, you know, he has things he could say. I mean, there was a very interesting interview that he did about his wife's when she was diagnosed with MS. And he apparently said to her, you know, she was afraid she wouldn't be able to handle her responsibilities. And he said, you know, I like peanut butter sandwiches. We could live on peanut butter sandwiches. It doesn't matter to me. That's a very humanizing detail that kind of makes him seem more down to earth than a guy with Cayman Island and Swiss bank accounts. But, you know, you haven't heard him talk like that. You don't really get any concrete sense of him as a real guy.
And you also know that he never really has to succumb to eating peanut butter sandwiches. There's enough stashed away. You mentioned humor. The Times had an interesting piece yesterday on humor in candidates and how they shy away from humor and become much more disciplined as they're in the race. Romney has kind of a problem with humor. Obama's not a particularly funny guy. I'm always wondering why they don't use a lot more humor, because it's such a natural connection with audiences. We like to laugh.
Well, humor can really go off track easily. I mean, the article you're referring to had a reference to a joke Obama made about his low bowling score qualifying him for the Special Olympics. I mean, that was a disaster.
It
he
was.
Had to call the Shrivers. I mean, it was awful. And, you know, Romney tried to be funny when he told a group of unemployed people that he was unemployed, too. But that wasn't very funny.
No,
so, I mean, if I were unemployed and had $250 million, I don't know. So that's, you know, that was, it's risky. Some people can really pull it off. Sometimes Obama can pull it off, but most of the time it's better to be safe in a situation where there's always somebody with a cell phone taking video.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, and YouTube just a click away.
Yeah. Who's the funniest person you've covered? You've covered a lot. You've been in this for a while. Were there people you just loved to listen to because of their humor?
Well, John McCain was funny. I mean,
was he
used
funny?
The same. Yeah, he was. He used very tired jokes in his speeches, but off the trail, he was really pretty funny. But also, you know, he was kind of. It was understood that you weren't going to put some of this. You know, he had an understanding with the press, and he would be off the record, but he would be funny.
Yeah.
So that's who I would say.
We were talking, my husband and I, about the percentage of Mormons who were in the Nevada caucus, and you not only gave us that statistic, 7% of the population, but I found this to be interesting, Jill, as in 2008, they accounted for a quarter of caucus goers, and of course, 9 in 10 of them chose Romney. That's a lot of caucus goers.
It really is. I mean, they seem very, very energized by his candidacy, and that'll help him. I mean, they're not an overwhelming number. I think if Obama mobilizes in Nevada, he can, union vote, the Hispanic vote, he has a greater natural advantage. But it's this caucus really showed that for the second time in a row, Romney can really count on his fellow Mormons there.
Mm-hmm. And you also did a piece on who is most likely to capture Nevada, the Democrats or the Republicans, and your answer is?
Well, I don't think I actually answered that question. I think I raised it. That is the big mystery. It has 6 electoral votes, and it switched big time to Democrat in 2008. Obama won it by 12 points. I don't think that'll happen again. He might win it, but not by 12. So, Nevada is the top in all the categories you don't want to be top in. It's got the highest unemployment. It's got the highest foreclosure rate. And so the question is, will they give Obama more time to help them, or will they decide to give Romney a chance? And the problem for Romney is that his idea of help is to let the housing market hit bottom, and that's going to be a hard sell in Nevada, where, you know, almost every neighborhood is decimated by these foreclosures. It's really terrible what's gone on out there.
Why did that hit Nevada so hard?
You know, I think the recession just, you know, you have an economy that's very one-dimensional. It depends on hospitality, leisure, gaming, tourism. And so that's the first to go when people don't have any money. And so that, in turn, toppled the construction industry, which was the other big source of revenue in Nevada. And so you had those two industries just in a tailspin.
Hmm. Jill Lawrence, our guest for All Things Political. We have one line open if you'd like to grab it. We're going to start going to your phone calls in a minute here. She is the National Journal's Managing Editor for Politics, and our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Oh, and the email, I just gave that to you. You do it by rote. You forget you said it. I said it. You got the number. You got the email. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, celebrations are taking place all over the world this year, and particularly this week, to mark the bicentenary of the birth of Charles Dickens, whose birthday is actually tomorrow, February 7. Our guest is Martin Fido, who is author of The World of Charles Dickens. Let's go to phone calls for Jill Lawrence. Muhammad in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Muhammad.
Good morning, Kathleen. My question to your guest is whether she thinks when it gets into the general election with Governor Romney as the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, the theology of Mormonism is not going to be kind of like President Obama's association with Reverend Wright at one point. It was overcome, but I'm surprised that besides in the Southern evangelical community, where as people become more aware of what the Mormon beliefs are, as I have recently, looking at a PBS documentary and reading other literature, if or why is if not, it isn't going to just become an issue.
Well, I think it very well could become an issue. I think the major danger is that the evangelical voters won't turn out in the numbers that Romney needs them to. There was an interesting column in the New York Times this weekend by Frank Bruni, who argued that perhaps Romney should talk more about his religion. He felt that it might cut for him because he, you know, it's kind of, he felt like it was a central part of his soul and his core, and that people who feel they don't know him, that's the reason why. I am not sure how negatively it would impact him in general. I think the figure is that only about 20% of people said it would make a difference in how in their voting. So I think we can expect it to come up. I think it will be more of an issue, but I don't think it's going to be determinative.
He doesn't talk about it hardly at all, does he?
No, he really doesn't, and I think it is a big part of him. So I kind of am interested in this Frank Bruni theory that we would all know him a lot better if he did talk about it. Now, I think that some of his positions would there's a theory, a school of thought that he will never change his positions again because he can't afford to be seen as changing his positions again, in which case he has a lot of positions that very conservative Christians and evangelicals would really want to see in the White House. And so that could help counteract some of the impact if there's any negativity surrounding the Mormon issue.
Do you see any parallels at all to Kennedy and Catholicism in 1960?
You know, people talk about that, and Romney tried to address that in 2008. I think, you know, maybe it's because I don't remember much about that time. I was a kid. But it seems like Mormonism is a more exotic religion, and the whole polygamy angle has, you know, is part of that. And you know, there is the history of Romney's own family. His great-grandfather went to Mexico in order to have more than one wife. And so that's why the family lived in Mexico. And his father moved to the United States when he was seven. So there are these elements that are different than other religions, which could make it a more serious obstacle.
Either that or we're entering an age of open marriage and who knows?
That's true.
Yeah.
And of course, the Romneys like to say that he's the only one who has had one wife.
Right. And that's funny.
Right.
Yeah,
that is funny.
That's funny. Muhammad, thanks for the call. Bill in Madison. Hi.
Yeah, I'd like to comment both on caucuses and on presidential humor. Anyway, as far as caucuses, I disagree with both the guest and I think the host here. I get the sense that everyone thinks caucuses are bad and we should all go to primaries. I'm absolutely the opposite viewpoint. I believe that if you have a Democrat or a Republican who is running as a Democrat or a Republican, you should have Democrats, Republicans who are actively interested in the Democratic or Republican Party picking them. And if they're not interested enough to go to the caucuses, well, they take potluck. The idea that the other issue is strategic voting. I mean, I have coworkers who have bragged to me that they'll go if the person that they're in favor of is unopposed, for example, an incumbent like Obama is opposed in the Democratic Party, they'll go and vote for the Republican that they think is going to be weakest against their guy, in order to distort the democratic process in a sense. And I just don't like it. I mean, I just think that Republicans should pick Republicans and Democrats should pick Democrats. And if you're interested, if you're that interested in it, you will show up to the caucus and, contribute your piece.
Right.
But I don't think that non-party members
should participate.
Or people who are apolitical should be allowed to make these decisions.
All right. On to humor.
As far as presidential humor is concerned, there's two presidents that you never ever saw as being funny in public, but books written about them by people who knew them in the White House, when they were in the White House, said that they were hilariously funny just to be around. A Secret Service member who was in the White House detail during the Nixon years said that Nixon was a scream. And I saw Nixon on Johnny Carson once before he was Johnny, and he was funny.
Okay, chill.
Well, I am just speechless at the Nixon news. Where were those tapes?
Really? That's right. They were must have been erased.
Right. As far as the caucus question, I mean, you can have closed primaries where only Republicans are allowed to vote in Republican primaries and only Democrats are allowed to vote in Democratic primaries. I mean, there is an argument to be made for that. The argument for letting people cross over or letting independents vote is that you see who has more broad appeal in a general election. In terms of strategic voting, I think studies have shown that this is just very much overstated. That Rush Limbaugh tried to do that in the Indiana primary to try to keep Hillary Clinton in the race. It just doesn't. It doesn't happen in significant numbers, and it doesn't affect the outcome. And in terms of caucuses, the idea that if you care enough, you'll come, to have a caucus on a Saturday when a lot of people are working, particularly in an economy like Nevada, which is based on the hospitality industry, they can't make it, or they have children obligations, or, just people's lives are not flexible enough sometimes for them to take a couple hours and go to a caucus on a Saturday or whenever a caucus is. So it's just not as voter-friendly a format as a primary.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. David in Madison, hi.
Thank you. A note and then a couple of questions. Thanks for your time. First of all, I think in Nevada was a part of the biggest expansion, the rapid expansion that came to be known as housing bubble. That might also be a reason why they were hit so hard, that so many easy loans there at the last few years. But my comment there, question is, Wall Street Journal today, Romney gains momentum. Everybody's saying Romney gains momentum. Here's the first question, and I have a second one if there's time, and that is, 4 years ago, Romney got 51% in Nevada against arguably a stronger candidate pool than this year. This year he got 50%. Both years, obviously, there's a substantial Mormon minority that we know goes 90%+ for Romney. How in the world is that extra momentum? I think it shows perhaps that maybe the opposite, or at least a flattening. The other question goes to the core of Romney. I see that Romney's picked up two things. One, he obviously is the Democrat Party, and this is a tired old thing that Newt Gingrich introduced in 1994. And the Democratic Party's been around for 200 years, and as a sign of utter disrespect to not let someone name themselves, and that's what this Republican Walker does it, of course, too, to say Democrat Party. It's the Democratic Party. You can really tell who's respectful or not. The other thing is that Romney very often, not always, but mostly, does this thing where he calls President Obama, Obama, rather than President Obama. Okay, after you've said the name three or four times, maybe Obama, but at the start of your speech or your answer, you should say President. It's part of the Republican whole scheme that, you know, he's not really the president, wink, wink. So any thoughts on those comments?
Thank you, David.
Well, just to take the second one first, I haven't noticed that about Romney and not saying President Obama, but I would bet that in a general election situation, if he's the nominee, he will be incredibly respectful of him and the office because people like Obama and they respect the presidency, and he's not going to want to get on the wrong side of that great middle ground in the electorate. So if it's happening, I bet it'll stop. In terms of momentum, it's well, first of all, this is the first time this season that we've had someone win back-to-back contests because we had so many different winners in the first few. So that in itself counts for something. It's also a different part of the country. He's now won in the North, in the South, and in the West. So, you know, that's another good sign for him. And, you know, maybe he's reached a ceiling in Nevada. Maybe he can't get more than half the vote in a Republican caucus there. But I'm not sure, you know, we have multi-candidate fields both these years. I'm not sure that that's such a terrible outcome. He got more than twice as much as his nearest competitor. And, you know, I would not deny him the momentum. I think he's probably going to win Colorado tomorrow. And, you know, he might even have a shot at Minnesota. So, you know, you can't deny that the guy's on a roll.
Has Pawlenty endorsed Romney?
Yes, and he's been very active with conference calls and appearances for him.
Thanks, David, very much for the call. Joan in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Thank the gentleman from Madison for bringing up the overgrowth in the real estate industry in Las Vegas. Went back at least 20 years where senior citizens were moving from Wisconsin to Nevada. And I just had personal experience with a friend of mine doing that. And I think it's a cautionary tale for us here in Wisconsin, because in today's paper, I know there's a letter, and the headline of the letter is a cautionary tale about worshiping growth, that bigger is better. And in Wisconsin here, our Governor Walker has certainly bent over backwards to help real estate developers in every way that he can. And this is just building for a bubble. And I think it's a cautionary tale for us. Thank you.
Thank you. You want to comment, or is that just...
The only thing I'd say is that Wisconsin has a much more diversified economy than Nevada, which is good for it. And there seems to be a focus now on reviving manufacturing, which is also good for it. So hopefully more people will be able to afford those mortgages they took out.
Yeah. Thanks, June, for the call. A couple lines are open. 800-486-8655 is our number, and it's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network for Monday, the 6th of February. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. Mitt Romney has proved that foot and mouth disease is heritable, and I'm wondering if you'd comment on the situation whereby Mitt's father in 1967 was running for president, and he didn't have a policy as to what he was going to do. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War, and he didn't have a policy concerning the war. He said he had to go over there first and see what was going on, and then come back, and he'd let us know. Well, he did that and came back and said, I've been brainwashed. And that was the end of his candidacy. But Mitt has gotten at least three or four strikes at the ball. Three strikes at the ball in this campaign, similar to his father's faux pas. And you know, what are we in different times, or don't we think that if he was president that would get him in trouble? I mean, like start a war or something.
When you talk about faux pas? Are you talking about when he calls Obama an appeaser, an apologist, that sort of thing?
No, when he says, I like to fire people, and I don't care about the rich, and I don't care about the poor.
Okay, well, those things are all kind of go to his personal qualities and his personal appeal. So I don't know about whether he would get us in a war. He has a very hawkish foreign policy, which I mean, he and the other Republicans seem quite eager to invade Iran or go to war on Iran, you know, there's no guarantee that Obama won't do that, but he doesn't seem quite as eager. So there is that. But that's, I think, very deliberate and studied. The other remarks that you're talking about go to his kind of his past as a rich person and also a boss in charge of a lot of things. And he's has proven to be fairly insensitive about that. And that could damage him in the election. I'm not sure what impact it would have on his policies.
Let's talk for a moment about Iran, because it seems to me as though there could be big trouble down the road in the next few months concerning our relationship with that country and Israel's relationship with that country. Do you suspect, do you know if there are top-level negotiations going on with the Israelis as to whether or not there will be a bombing by Israel that we will be supporting, or what's going on with all of that? You just keep hearing hints every now and then.
You know, I don't want to pretend to be an expert on what's going on at the highest levels of our government regarding Iran.
Yeah.
I'm a political person, and I listen to what people are saying. And what I hear is Obama being very cagey and, you know, kind of not committing any which way, just trying to be reassuring to Americans and probably crossing his fingers that gas prices aren't going to go through the roof.
Mm-hmm. And the Journal talked about, as everybody's talked about, Mitt's comments about the very poor. I think that you didn't necessarily write this, but it was in the hotline on call that his gaffe in speaking about poor Americans wasn't a game changer, but it underscored his vulnerabilities being perceived as the candidate of the upper class, detached from the economic concerns of the working class. Is he going to be hammered on that comment for months to come?
Well, you know, it's just the latest scene in a highlight reel that you could put together with all of these comments that he's made. He has a tin ear about this stuff. I mean, when he says corporations are people, when he says that, you know, he wants to make a $10,000 bet with someone, when he says that he didn't really make very much money from speaking fees and it turns out he made $374,000, when he jokes that he's unemployed or that he once worried about getting a pink slip, you know, these all feed into this narrative that he really doesn't get what it's like to not have money or to be financially insecure. So, yeah, I think he is going to get hammered on it, and I think he already is getting hammered on it. Newt Gingrich hammered on it on Saturday night and Sunday morning. So, you know, it'll just – who's doing the hammering will change, but, yeah, I think it'll continue.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kenneth. Steve in Jackson. Hi.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering – this is a pretty general question, but given all the controversy that came out of the last midterm election – I'm just wondering if your guest might give us some thoughts on the possibility of getting rid of the midterm elections and just having all the general elections rolled together every 4 years. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Steve.
Well, you know, the House was formed to be in very close touch with the grassroots, and if you make the terms longer, then you're not going to sort of have your finger on the pulse of the people. So I think that those two-year terms, you know, they're there to stay, and it's kind of like a pendulum swing sometimes. We've saw it in 2006, 2008, 2010, but that's the way the founders meant it to be. So, you know, it may seem very unstable and kind of like a roller coaster ride, and I think we're going to see a big swing. I don't know if Democrats will take control again, but we will see a big swing most likely this year, and that's just you know, part of democracy that we should learn to love.
Okay.
We're volatile.
We'll learn to love it, Jill. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. What I'd like to talk about today is a little bit about how the Republicans run con games on the intelligence of people and manipulate us on it. For example, Romney was saying something about that Obama would and his friends in the faculty lounge as a put down on teachers, for example. And of course, they use these words very carefully. They could use break room, but faculty lounge kind of suggests that these people are laying back and coasting on the government dime. And yet, you know, what do they do in practice? They act on a consistent basis like they're smarter than the average bear because they can con manipulate them, for example, on issues like race. And a recent book by Robert Kiyosaki, who really takes on both parties, the rich dad, poor dad author, wrote a new book in 2009 called Conspiracy of the Rich, 8 Rules on Money. And in there he talks about, in a chapter, about why money is not taught in school, and he says, he cites a quote about a policy that the Rockefellers actually put in around the turn of the century in 1903. The purpose of the foundation was to use the power of money not to raise the level of education in America, as was widely believed at the time, but to influence the direction of that education. The object was used, the classroom, to teach attitudes that encourage people to be passive and submissive to their rulers. The goal was and is to create citizens who are educated enough for productive work under supervision, but not enough to question authority or to seek to rise above their class. True education was to be restricted to the sons and daughters of the elite. For the rest, it would be better to produce skilled workers with no particular aspirations other than to enjoy life. So by not having controversy in the classroom and not teaching us about how money works, the idea was to produce useful idiots who could be manipulated for the benefit of the rich.
Jill.
Well, let's see where to start. Okay. The faculty lounge, I thought, was kind of a reference to elite thinkers. Romney used to talk about Harvard faculty lounge, but in fact, the score of Romney to Obama is 2-1 on Harvard degrees, because Romney has a law and a business degree from Harvard. So I think that's the elitist charge there, which is, you know, if anyone really thought about it, one elitist talking to another elitist, it's not really, it's kind of a wash. And I don't know that I don't look at America and see a passive people. I mean, we've had the Tea Party, we've had Occupy Wall Street, we've had people who are very concerned about spending and about income inequality. I think that we have a pretty active populace these days, and that's healthy.
Thanks so much for the call, Jim. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 6th of February. Jill Lawrence is our guest. She is managing editor of politics for National Journal. She has been covering every presidential campaign since 1988, many other historic events, the 1994 Republican takeover of Congress, the Clinton impeachment, the Florida recount, and the battles over health reform. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. And if you can't get through, you can always use an email if you have access to a computer. It's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today. Tomorrow is Charles Dickens' 200th birthday. We will be talking about perhaps the most important novelist, essayist of the Victorian era. Hour two of our show. Jill Lawrence is here now for All Things Political. Our next call is Taylor from Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. Wanted to know if you could comment anything on the possible voter fraud in Nevada that I've heard about. I haven't read anything in depth yet, only heard flashes of it on the news and such. And then just wanted to comment on Iran. I can't remember your exact words, but you said it seemed like the Republican Party candidates were pretty bent on going to war with Iran. And I just read a snippet from Yahoo News that Obama now has kind of backed off Iran a little bit. And I think that comes from the Ron Paul stance and the people who are independent-minded and possible supporters of the Ron Paul presidency have forced that issue to go that way?
In terms of Iran, I think that Obama's just really trying to be cagey on this, and he is very reluctant to do more interventions than he has to. He's taking a lot of heat from the Republican candidates for bringing the troops home from Iraq. He's taking a lot of heat for trying to get them out of Afghanistan before commanders say they want them out. And he took a lot of heat on Libya, even though it was we didn't have any casualties. It was a very it was a joint production with a lot of allies, and it was very effective. So I don't think he's looking for intervention in Iran. He has said that he would like a peaceful solution to the whole prospect of a nuclear Iran. So I'm not sure. I think that Ron Paul is tapping into the same vein that Obama is, that people just are very fatigued with war, and that, you know, the Republicans are kind of swimming against the tide on that one.
We haven't spent much time talking about Ron Paul. The National Journal Hotline on Call says if Texas Representative Ron Paul is going to be a serious factor in securing delegates, this is his make-or-break month.
That is probably because this is a month with a lot of caucuses in it, and he is a very good organizer. He's proven that by winning a lot of straw polls this year and last year, and caucuses rely above all on organization. Can you get your people to actually come to a meeting with their neighbors to talk about the presidential race? And so his test in Nevada didn't go so well. He was third. And so he has now, we have Minnesota, Colorado, and Maine in the next few days. And he's spent a lot of time in Maine. He's spending a lot of time in Minnesota. So the question is, you know, will he be able to do better than third and fourth? You know, he needs to really show that he can give Romney some competition. And if he can't, then, then he's got lots more to prove coming up.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to foreign policy for just a moment. Polls show that the American public is just not really keen on focusing a great deal of attention on foreign policy. It is one of, most people would agree, the president's strong points, in that he's effectively dismantled a lot of al-Qaeda. He's been pretty successful in this realm. Would it behoove him to concentrate on the death of Osama bin Laden and the successes in the foreign policy realm, or is it best for him to just not spend a lot of time on that because, after all, we are concerned about the economy?
I do think that it would be wise for him to talk about that during the campaign. I don't think he's going to have a choice because I think he's going to be attacked on it. I'm not sure what Republicans hope to gain from that, but, you know, they certainly are going after him, particularly Romney, going after him on his record as a commander-in-chief. So, I don't see how that works out for him. The Republicans are pursuing a policy that looks a lot like George W. Bush, and people made pretty clear that they didn't want any more of that. So it may be effective in a Republican primary. It'll be interesting to see if he tempers that in a general election, because I just can't, you know, if you picture the two of them, Romney and Obama, up on a debate stage, and Romney starts talking about Obama as a weak leader, I just don't see how that works.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, yeah. Thanks, Taylor. Jeff in Palmyra, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to discuss about the unemployment figures. I think it makes for a great soundbite, but in reality, it's not really that factual. There's a big difference between unemployment and out of work. I find it interesting that comes to an election year, suddenly unemployment is dropping. Yet if what I'm reading, and when you dig a little bit deeper into the facts, you find out that the Department of Labor just recently dropped 1.2 million people from the workforce because they say they are no longer seeking a job. Well, that doesn't mean that they're not unemployed. It just means they're no longer seeking a job.
Yeah, I think Jill referenced that earlier, that what if they show up and they're on the market again, and then it messes around with the rate again.
Well, that is true. That is a big problem, and it's a big problem politically for Obama. It's obviously a big problem for people who want to go to work. I think the figures that are encouraging to people are even possibly more than the unemployment rate. Analysts look at the number of jobs created in the private sector, which I believe was over 240,000 in January, which was kind of a shock, especially because apparently, well, I mean, it's obvious to anyone who's paying attention, you know, the jobs usually drop in January because people who had temporary work for the holidays are laid off. Mm-hmm. So that was very impressive. Now, sometimes these numbers are modified, you know, as more information comes in. So we'll see what the ultimate number is. But it seems like it's got to be good, and it's much higher than what was expected.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for the call. Nancy in Eastman. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. It really bothers me that when people call up, they take Romney's phrases out of context. He did not say that it didn't bother him to fire people. What he said was it didn't bother him to fire people who were not doing their job. And that is my comment. It really bothers me, and it happens not only to Romney, but to other Republicans and to President Obama also. I just wish people would take the whole thing rather than just a snippet.
Thank you, Nancy.
Well, it's true. In particular, he was referring to firing insurance companies, which probably a lot of people could wish they could do. It must be said that one of the big scandals, if you can call it that, in advertising this year was a Romney campaign ad, which took President Obama completely out of context. It showed him saying that if he kept talking about the economy, he wouldn't win. And what he was doing was quoting a McCain aide in 2008 saying that if McCain talked about the economy, that he wouldn't win. So, you know, and the Romney campaign knew exactly what it had done. It even included the original full quote in its materials accompanying the ad when it told us all about them. And so, you know, it's a rough game, and he knows it. He plays it. So that's just the way it is.
Thanks, Nancy. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. First, I'd like to agree with an earlier caller about the Republicans having the right to choose their candidates and the Democrats and so forth. But I kind of wanted to point out an irony. Just recently in Iowa, the Iowa State Legislature had pushed through a voter ID law to reduce corruption in the election system, it's kind of funny in this case, but it wouldn't be if it were an official election. But when they ran their own caucus about a month or so ago, the party ran the caucus, and they still don't know who won because there are several precincts of voters that are still missing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, If they can't run their own caucus, I find it kind of interesting that they're attempting to lay down the ground rules for elections where there is almost no evidence of voter fraud in any of the states that have passed this voter ID law. And thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, I think you've just made the argument for letting states handle these elections because, you know, there really is very little fraud, very few cases ever documented in state elections. So, you know, if there were primaries, then the Secretary of State would be involved and the state of Iowa would be involved. It wouldn't be the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, there's no precision really in any kind of voting, and it only really matters when a race is close. But we seem to be having a lot of those lately, starting, of course, with Florida in 2000. But, you know, the Iowa caucuses were another example where the first round, Mitt Romney won by 8, and in the final, or as final as we're ever going to get, Rick Santorum won by 34.
Right. And as final as we're ever going to get, you say, come on, let's be final about it.
Well, 8 precincts are missing forever. So, yes, that's the final answer.
That's the final answer. So, Jill, what's coming up this week now? It's hard to keep track of all of these.
Right. Tomorrow night we have Colorado and Minnesota caucuses.
Oh.
And Romney seems to be ahead in Colorado. Minnesota is possibly Newt Gingrich's only chance to win something in February.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to work. Some of the interesting things to think about are whether Michelle Bachmann is going to endorse anybody. We know that the former governor, Tim Pawlenty, has already endorsed Romney. And we just had this morning, apparently, Ed Morrissey, the blogger from HotAir.com. He's from Minnesota, and he endorsed Rick Santorum.
Yeah, so did Pat Boone, didn't he?
Yes,
I read
Pat
that yesterday
Boone.
Somewhere.
That's right.
Pat
yes,
Boone.
You did.
Right.
Right.
Well, there's a big endorsement, huh?
Right. Well, in case you were worrying that Santorum might not be wholesome enough or Christian enough or, you know, he's definitely the social conservative favorite.
Right. In any debates coming up anytime soon, or have we had our fill of all of those?
No, we're going to have on February 22nd because towards the end of the month we have Arizona and Michigan primaries, which should be interesting.
Yeah, and then the big Super Tuesday in
right,
March
6th. Yeah. Right.
Well, Jill, thank you very much. It was just a really good hour, and thanks for all of your knowledge.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Good. Yeah, I had fun, too. It was fun. Jill Lawrence, Managing Editor of Politics for National Journal. She's also worked as Senior Correspondent and Columnist for Politics Daily, National Political Correspondent for USA Today, National Political Writer for the Associated Press, and she's written about politics for the Daily Beast, the Atlantic, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and many other publications. It's a good site. There's in-depth and keen political analysis at the National Journal for those of you who are politics junkies, and that I assume that's everybody who listens to this hour because All Things Political is on this hour every week from 9 until 10. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing this interesting hour and for on-air production as well. We'll return.